sacred seats, and as we said, Shabbat Vayikra. There it is, as always. It always makes me smile every time I look at that picture. It's like, week by week, there's a different parasha, but the Torah never changes. It's always the same portion, apparently. Not that we're going to start taking random photographs, because that would, I'm getting a shake of the head there. That is not going to happen. We're not going to photograph each portion and put it up there. That's way too much. But there it is. It is Vayikra. What a lovely, some of the readings that we had there today, especially the one from the Masonic writings. That right story epistle, I think, is as Luther once called it, and Yaakov, otherwise known as James. You can't help but read through that letter and you just think, this is Judaism. I mean, what else is it? I mean, I'm sorry. You just listen to those words. It's not anything else, is it? It's got to be Judaism. This is not some new religion that's being written about here in any way, shape or form. And I think as we get into the word this morning, you'll realise just how much that is Judaism that's going on there. So in a slightly reverse order, seeing as we started with that one, the reading from the Masonic writings today was Yaakov 2, 1 through to 13. From the Torah it was Leviticus 1, 1 to 9. And the Haftarah was Yeshayahu, Isaiah 44, 1 through to 8. We're in a new book, and yet in many ways we're not in a new book. You know, if you go back through ancient times, you'll know that the Torah was written in one long continuous sentence. Word breaks, chapter breaks, as it were, or gaps in the text and between the books that didn't exist. You had to know how to read it. Or the breaks that we've now got, and certainly in our modern English forms where we've got each of the verses numbered and the chapters numbered and so on. None of that was in the original. It was one long, continuous revelation. And actually, Vayikra really proves this to us, shows us this. It begins with something which, if you were taught in the 1970s in a UK school, I suspect you would have had your wrist slapped if you did it, that you never start a sentence with "and." Right? I mean, my goodness, the number of times I did it and got a clip around the ear or whatever from my English teacher back in the days when you could do that legally. But you learn the lesson, I guess, you never start a sentence with "and." Well, I do hope those teachers never read the Bible, because they're in for a shock. Because in the Hebrew, at least, it's and. It's and is running all the way through. And Vayikra begins with "and." Vayikra, anti-call. And. In other words, there's something before it. It doesn't just end with the book of Exodus and goes into Leviticus, Vayikra, that way. The "v" tells us you've got to keep reading. It's a continuation, the so-called vav of continuation from Exodus. Not getting these line breaks and book breaks. And then you saw it there when it was held up, that kind of the three-line gap and so on. All of that is a later addition, really. It just is one long story of deliverance, salvation and redemption. And so we move on, really, in this understanding that the Mishkan has been built. And as we were saying last week, it's a beautiful place. You can stand there and take photos of it, put it on Instagram and walk around and go, look at this, quick TikTok video, standing in front of things, You could do all of that and it would be utterly pointless, a waste of space. Just pretty videos until something begins to happen in it. That's what we were saying, wasn't it, last week? And we know what happens in the Mishkan, sacrifices. A real affront to modern man, the blood-drenched reality of it all. It must have been quite actually horrific for people who don't like blood and don't like the thought of that. It must have been quite a shock to the eyes, although I suspect, given the way life was at the time, that you were killing your own animals to eat them, maybe not as much as a shock as it would be to modern man today. The beautiful exterior only ever pointed to the internal reality, the spiritual reality of it all. And you cannot help but notice when you do this as to link the two together from last week about the centrality of sacrifice. This is meant to be the narrative of Israel's calling. Sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. Just this first few chapters of Leviticus. You know, it's one of the things that if you're not a believer, you pick up the book of Leviticus and you get two chapters in, you go, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm going to go and find some Dickens or something. It's going to be a bit more, you know, it is literally page after page after page of killing animals. And very easy to get put off by that on one level, but it shows us that the sheer volume and amount of sacrifices going on here, you cannot avoid the ultimate conclusion. Judaism, right? Judaism, as revealed in the Torah, as the centre part of Judaism, clearly is sacrifice. I'm not making this up. It's there. And a Judaism without sacrifice at the heart of it, I'm going to say, is a Judaism that is missing key components of understanding, of function, of calling and task. Sacrifice is at the heart of it all. Why? Well, we see this with we said at the end of the bit that immediately comes before that, and God came down and dwelt in the Mishkan. Sacrifice makes a way for God to dwell with us. It makes a way for God to come close to us, to overcome the sin that breaks that barrier, that creates that barrier, and overcomes it, that God can now draw close to us once more. Sacrifice makes a way. It is critical. Because ultimately God wants to dwell with us. That's what he said, makes it clear. All of which, of course, we begin to peel it back and you think, okay, this is great, the sacrifice is happening, but we want to, as always, look a little bit further under the hood, deconstruct a little bit, let's rip out the nuts and bolts and let's see what we find, and let's see if we can find a trail that takes us all the way through this. Because if I ask you the question, what is sacrifice? You would probably give the answers that I've already been talking about here today. Sacrifice is killing an animal. Wrong. That is not sacrifice. Do you know what sacrifice is? Let me give you the definition from the Torah, right? Sacrifice is this. This comes from Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 4. It talks about the burnt offering. The priest will put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. It's really interesting. It's not just putting an animal to death. You can do that in the back garden. I mean, you shouldn't. It's illegal, but don't start doing it. But, you know, that's just an act. It's not just about the animal dying. There's a process. There's a transaction. There's something happening with the death of that animal which is utterly fundamental and crucial to understanding really what Judaism is all about. Because if we understand that Judaism begins in the garden, in the broadest sense of the word, the Torah begins with Genesis after all, and with the story that we read there, the understanding in history that mankind rebelled against God and then sin came into the world and therefore was separated from God, then if Judaism is anything at all, it is the story about how God repairs that mistake that man made. How does God draw close again to the human beings that he has created? And we begin to now really see the answers, the way this happens, the process that is going on here. Leviticus 1:4, you lay the hand on the head of the animal and you confess your sins, and the animal dies on your behalf. Because that poor animal's never done anything wrong. It didn't speed along the road outside the school at 94 miles an hour. You did that. It didn't murder your neighbour because you wanted his car. You did that. But it says quite clearly, on your behalf, atonement is possible. Because of your sin, the animal dies. There's a transaction going on here. A contract made that satisfies both parties connected to it. And then you begin to realise, of course, that all our modern ideas of sacrifice and you know, modern sociologists and anthropologists and religious historians and all the rest of it who look at all of these things, and my goodness, books and volumes have been written all about this, you know, that the idea of sacrifice is some kind of offering to an angry, tempestuous, capricious, bloodthirsty deity who we just absolutely have to appease if we're going to get some rain for our crops. You know, that's the kind of modern image which is presented, Aztecs and so on. That this is the real kind of sociological reason why sacrifice happens. Absolute rubbish, at least as far as Judaism is concerned. Absolute rubbish. Sacrifice is a contract. It's a transaction. It's a price being paid. You deserve to die for your sins. How do we know this? The soul that sins shall surely die. Right? Very clear. Even in the garden, that pattern was established. It says in Bereshit 2:17, in the day you eat of the tree, you shall surely die. There's a punishment that comes if you sin in that way. Sin brings death into the world, and it did. It still brings death into the world. Every single day you see it all around the world right now. How do we connect that with the animal? What are we going to do with that? But as a system, as a structure, this transactional element that's going on here. It's actually quite interesting when you look at it in a kind of a legal way, in this way, because it becomes far more obvious what's happening. It's a purchase, a statement of contractual standing, and it happens because it satisfies the justice and righteousness of God. And that is critical. It satisfies his justice. It satisfies his righteousness, and I mean his sense of justice and righteousness, not that of mankind necessarily, but it does satisfy God's sense of justice. If sin brings death, and the Lord promised in the day you eat of the tree you will surely die, that was not just a throwaway comment where one day he says this and then says, but it's open to negotiation and maybe we'll dial back on it. No, no, no. The Lord said it, he meant it. You sin, it will bring death into your life. That's the way it is. Human death is the punishment, and I mean the punishment justly given for sin. It's about justice. You know, our God does not look down on people who murder in this world and go, oh, there, never mind. Oh, I get it. Yeah, your dad stole your sweeties when you were three. I get it. Never mind, eh? We'll forget the murder. That is not God. There's justice with our God. A real justice with him. He sees what human beings do. He sees the way that sin ripples through our life and leads to death in there. And because he is just and he is righteous, he will fulfill his word, and death comes to humanity. The reason that sacrifices are in the book of Leviticus is not because God woke up one day, as it were, and thought, you know what, I need an altar. Let's have some animals to die on it. It wasn't a clever idea. You don't put animals to death for fun. They are living beings. It is important. If you're going to kill an animal, there has to be a deep, meaningful, real reality to this. You don't play with this concept. And it's because of God's justice that this situation comes about with the Mishkan. Death has to happen. And in the human place, in that reality, let me read it to you again. It says quite clearly, and if you lay your hands on that animal, confess your sin, the animal's death will be accepted on your behalf to make atonement for you. In other words, the death of that animal represents your death. It's called justice. For the sin, the soul that sins shall surely die. God is just. Absolutely just. It is just because God is our judge in all of this. He either rewards or judges depending on how we live and respond. And honestly, if God is not just, if God is not our judge, then he can begin by apologizing to Sodom and Gomorrah. We saw how he acted at that point. We will not mock God and say that he is unable to bring justice and judgment into this world, because he is bringing justice and judgment into this world right now. And you can see it everywhere if you've got eyes to see it. Our God is acting because he is just. Justice belongs to the Lord. Sacrifice happens because it's part of his justice system. It's not a game. It's justice. Seen to be done. The death happens in that way. And each animal that died was meant to be, as it were, not a physical, but a maybe spiritual slap around our faces of, this should be you. Poof. That should be you. Poof. Every single time. There should be that recognition, a wake-up call for us. God's justice is visible and laid bare for everyone to see and take notice of. It's called substitutionary atonement. And I'm going to say it, it is the bedrock of what Judaism is. Some people may not like that. I say read the Torah. That's it. It's there. That is what it should be. And if our concepts of Judaism have wandered and drifted away from the Torah ideas that we have here, then guess who should move? It's not the Torah. We need to get back to the Torah. Get back to these Jewish ideas of what's really going on. What is the reality in all of this? Substitutionary atonement lays at the very heart of what the Jewish faith should be. And then it was, everything else makes sense, doesn't it? In many, many ways. All the way down to Yeshua. It all makes sense in that way. God is just. And his justice is always true and right. And thankfully, his mercy endures forever. And his mercy triumphs over judgment. We were reading that, didn't we, in Yaakov as well. It's a beautiful thing that, you know, God is just. His justice will come, his judgment will come, his mercy prevails, and he's waited for so long, but eventually his judgment and justice will come too. We cannot play with his mercy in that way and think another day will come. It runs all the way through the scriptures. I'm going to read some of the ideas around this, because looking at sacrifices this way opens up another door. Now, we can talk about that. We've done sacrifices in previous years and so on in so many, many different ways. But I really wanted to dig into this idea of sacrifice as justice. Justice before God. And I'm going to read some thoughts and ideas here for you. This is, first of all, from a little bit further on in Leviticus 19. This is 19:15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honour the person of the mighty, rich, powerful. But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbour. So first of all, I mean, there's a whole sermon just in that single verse, but let's just pick a couple of thoughts out of there right away. You shall judge your neighbour. So all the people walk around going saying, oh, thou shalt not judge. Thou shalt not judge. I'm sorry, it says here, you shall judge your neighbour. But you do it in the right way. You stand them before a court. You put them before a judge. That is not necessarily you, right? But you shall judge your neighbour. But it's absolutely rock bottom in all of this. You shall do no injustice in judgment. When we are in judgment, we shall not cloud that judgment by yet further injustice. And how do you do that? You should be partial to the poor, or honour the person of the rich or the mighty. You know, you get to a point where someone's in the court and goes, oh, you know what? You're poor. I'm going to be lenient to you because you're poor. That is not justice. That is not justice. Someone comes in who's rich, or mighty, or powerful, politically powerful maybe, right? Maybe a king or a queen. ends up in court. I've never seen a king in court or queen in court. So theoretically it could happen. I would put some good money on it that it probably will never happen, but I mean theoretically it could. But you know, at that point as a judge, do you go, oh no, you're royalty, you couldn't possibly have done that? Well, think again. That's partiality. That's injustice in judgment. We should show no partiality to the rich or the poor, or, and here we go to make this really controversial, we should not show partiality in either direction to the powerful nor the vulnerable as they present themselves in our society. See, we're used to seeing this as a kind of rich and poor thing, and I'm kind of clouding it a little bit to get you thinking in that direction. I want to strip the finance out of this. I want to talk about the powerful and the vulnerable. People who have power, people who don't have power. Put that into that concept is quite interesting, isn't it, really? That, you know, you can either then just say to one point, you can say, okay, you are the powerful one, we respect power, we respect authority, you can't possibly have done wrong. Right? Alternatively, let's flip it on its head. Oh, you're the vulnerable one. You're vulnerable. You poor person. You must be the one that's being abused because you're vulnerable. And the Torah says that is injustice in judgment because you're allowing your preconditioned ideas to cloud your judgment at that point. Leviticus 19:15 says this. Let me read you another one. Because the themes run all the way through here again and again. It's really interesting. It's a repeated pattern when we're talking about the justice of the Lord. This comes from Exodus 23, picking up from 1 to 3. You shall not circulate a false report. That's lying, yes, on one level. Oh, but it's so much more than that. Circulating a false report is deliberately putting things in print, if you like, in modern terms, and circulating it on the internet or posting it out in emails or doing something with it with a deliberate intent to cause harm. And the Torah says that is sin. It's not justice. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Because it's so much fun, isn't it? Don't go and join in. Don't put your hand with that, with an unrighteous witness. It gets even worse than that. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil. Just because there's a group baying for blood, that does not make them right. Got it? It may look like it. Because they're a big number, right? Look at the number of people who are screaming for this person to be hung up. They've got to be right. There's so many of them. And the Torah says, no. That is not justice. Injustice in judgment, that is. Nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. It may suit you to do so. You might get money out of it. Whatever. Credibility, who knows? But you don't testify in a dispute to turn, to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. I think this is interesting. You know, this is, I've got one more coming up, but just pause for a second on this one. This is now the second time. You do not show partiality to the poor. It's really crazy, isn't it? You know, I wouldn't, if that had read, you shall not show partiality to the rich and powerful, I would not have been surprised, right? Because we can all sit here, even our modern day, and go, yeah, the rich and powerful, they always get away with everything, don't they? Like, we know, don't we? They always get away with everything, the rich and powerful. This is repeating not that, it says you don't actually show partiality to the poor, the vulnerable. In other words, you don't automatically assume that they are right, just because they are poor or vulnerable. That's a perversion of justice. But it's so easy to do, isn't it? Oh, you're the vulnerable one here. You're this, you're that. You've got these problems and these troubles, and you've got this, and you've got no income, or you've got that, and blah, blah, blah. You're the one whose life is a complete car crash. Therefore, you must be in the right. That is showing partiality in judgment, and it's unjust. Really interesting. It gets far more controversial when you think about it. Don't follow the crowd. You know what? The majority, whenever the majority has been right. I mean, look at democracy. Look at the crazy people who end up in power. Since when was the majority ever right? Honestly, the majority will go and say, you know what, we've founded the Lemmings Party. It's going to be great. I tell you, they would flock to it. Right? They'd have a great party. They'd be running on them, drinking and clinking and giving themselves tax breaks until the very day they'd run over the edge of the cliff. Democracy does not make right right. It doesn't do anything in that. If you want to know what is right, read the Torah. That's where you're going to find it. The crowd can be wrong, and honestly, frequently are. We look at the way the world is right now. The vulnerable may have a large company, but that doesn't make them automatically right. I was reading something just recently that was a real challenge. You know, you're trying to understand all kinds of scenarios, and it was very much about redressing the balance as it was perceived to be, to support the vulnerable. And you know, the vulnerable do need support. What they do not need is fake justice. In God's eyes, that's a sin. They do not need fake justice. Because you know what will happen at that point? Very quickly, you will have a line of vulnerable people in court saying, and that one, and that one, and can we have that one, and that. And the judge will be going, you know what? Oh, you're vulnerable. Of course you're right. Right, you, let's hang him. Let's put this one up on high. Let's put that away, one away for 10 years. Vulnerability does not necessarily make you right. I'm sorry, it doesn't. We do have a duty to support the vulnerable, but that does not mean that they are therefore unable to sin, get things wrong, and do things for selfish purposes which they want to do. That is just as powerful whether you're rich or poor. Talking about justice here, justice, how God sees justice. Again, one more, the last one, this is from Deuteronomy. It's a repeated pattern that comes up again and again and again, you know it does. This is Deuteronomy 1 and 16 and 17. Then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your brothers. Judge righteously between a man and his brother, or the stranger who is with him. So now it's reaching out on a number of levels, we can read that word, but on a basic level, it's even reaching out to one who is not even an Israelite. Even that person deserves justice in how they're treated. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small, the vulnerable, as well as the great. You shall not be afraid in any man's presence, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard, bring to me, and I will hear it. And it's interesting at that beginning of that verse there, you've got something called an exhortative command, exhortative verb, and it's actually shemoa. It's written in a slightly different way. It's an exhortation. It doesn't happen that often in the Hebrew, and it's really a demand to hear. In other words, what the Hebrew is saying to us at that point, it's not just hear the rich and the poor. It's not saying listen to them. What is actually demanding of the judge at that point is to really deeply dig down and find the truth and the reality, and therefore make a good judgment and bring real justice. Do not be afraid. It doesn't matter whether it's a king or a prime minister or a president or whether it's someone homeless standing before you in court. Do not fear who is there. You must be absolutely impartial and bring justice. And anything less than that is a crime against heaven. Because our God is absolutely just, and he expects us to be too. And I suppose there is a line in all of this which has possibly been niggling in my head for a long, long time. It's the way that our society in so many ways has Yes, supporting the vulnerable and helping the vulnerable, but maybe are we going too far in this, assuming the vulnerable must therefore be always right, that they can do no wrong? Maybe they can. And maybe real justice actually demands that we dig down. What are the motives? What's really going on? What is the evidence? And you'll know, if nothing else in the Torah, the evidence threshold is really high. You know, yes, there is such a thing as a capital punishment in Torah. There is. You are meant to stone someone. You are meant to take someone's life. It's in there. But you know what? To get to that level of absolute certainty that that person deserved it, the threshold is incredibly high. In other words, you'd be putting someone to death probably once every 20, 30, 50 years. Level high. You have to be absolutely clear and certain that the evidence is there. And the judge must have taken his time. It probably would have been his time to go down into the evidence and to find it. Absolutely no partiality must be shown. And don't be put off by, oh, you're the vulnerable person, oh, you poor this, oh, you poor that. Therefore, it must be the one who's got power who's doing the harm. Need not necessarily be true. Alright? And we need to bear this in mind. And again, just this last week, boy, there's been so much happening one week, it's crazy, but I remember this is the beginning of the week, this idea hit me, and it came about through, again, let's leave names out of it, but you'll soon know who I'm talking about, you know, leaders of a big political party in Europe, who was banned from running as president for 5 years this week. Now, I wasn't in that court case. I have no idea knowing whether she did these things or whether she didn't do these things. I am not a judge, so I'm not going to pass judgment. That's the simple reality of it. But isn't it interesting when someone's in that political situation that suddenly a court case appears which prevents them from, you know, I mean, I'm not into conspiracy theories, you know I'm not. But what I am saying is that we're looking at justice. Court cases against political leaders. There was one in the UK. Not that long ago, not to quite the same level as we saw there in the other country there. But you know, when someone's a leader and just said, oh, you know, no, actually, I think you said this, and this woman complained about that, and then boof, it was off, and then they were out of the political party. Prince Harry, I think we can talk about that one's in the Daily Mirror yesterday. I think we're on really safe ground with that one. Then his charity, who knows what went on? You know, let's not get involved in past judgment. On one level, I don't know what happened in that case. I have no idea. On one level, I feel sorry for Prince Harry because his name is splashed all over the Daily Mirror. That's his personal life. Is it justice? I don't know what happened to the chair of trustees and whether X happened or Y happened. I'm never going to know that. One level we do have to trust, and you know, but it's assumed, isn't it? Oh well, we know Prince Harry's the bad guy, isn't he? Because well, the Harry and Meghan thing, they're obviously the bad. No, that is showing partiality. And it's got to stop. It's unjust, it's unrighteous, and God is just. And we should be just. And then there's my final example, which is truly explosive. Because there are a group of people who are perceived by the world to be underdogs and vulnerable. And because, as we know, the underdogs and the vulnerable are always right, it's surely the place for the world to be supporting them and backing them and giving them every support that we can. And you know what that group is called? Hamas. Now, it may be controversial for a live stream, but you know it's true. They're perceived by the world to be the underdogs, and everyone loves an underdog, and they're the vulnerable ones, and therefore they must be in the right, and, well, you know what, therefore, who therefore has to be in the wrong, right? I'm saying, open your eyes. Look with justice and true righteousness. The problem we've got in the West is this theological cultural inheritance of liberation theology, which is still filtering down and wrecking perceptions of justice. All around us, it goes on and on. And calling out, I think, from scripture here today. So let's get back to a scriptural justice position. Our God is just. And just because it looks like the vulnerable and the weak, the ones who have the least weapons and so on, we've got to cry over them and blah, blah, blah. They may actually be the evil ones causing real damage and harm in this world. And maybe it's not the other party who are just fighting back, who everyone has painted as the bad guys in all of this. Step back and seek justice. Justice. Because our God is just. And he will not be deceived by tears on a TV camera. Because he knows. Justice is a core Jewish theology, core Jewish idea, because God is just. It sits at the heart of sacrifice as an idea, and we must strive for it if our faith is going to be real. And then we think, why is it that the world is in this place that it is, where justice, frankly, seems to be flying out the window? Right? It's just people trying today to find justice and not getting it, and court cases running and stuff going on that, frankly, you know, it's justice that we need to seek, and it seems to become the game of our society to play with this idea. What is causing this breakdown of justice? The answer may surprise you, actually. I'm going to read you a parable. In fact, I'm going to begin with the end of the parable. And then I'm going to tell you what the context is for that comment by Yeshua. You all know this one line. We've said it a million times. You'll be able to say it to anyone, you could quote it, you could even find it in the scriptures really easily. It's one that which we all know. And Yeshua said this: nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on earth? And you know, the interesting thing is that because that verse is used within the context of the end times and so on, people actually think Yeshua is talking about faith. And he is, on one level. But you know, don't take a text out of context. Right? You've got to see what is going on around this. Let me read the parable for which that line is Yeshua's conclusion. And it puts a very different understanding on it. Here we go. So Yeshua spoke a parable to them. This comes from Luke 18. Saying, men always ought to pray and not lose heart. Saying, there was a certain city, a judge, who did not fear God nor regard man. Now even at that stage of the parable, you're going, uh-oh, this isn't going to end well. A judge that doesn't fear God and doesn't fear man, that judge is not going to be a good judge, right? Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, avenge me of my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterwards he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continually coming, she weary me. He's not judging righteously, justly here. He's basically still being selfish and going, you know what? I'm fed up with her constant nagging. That is not the basis of justice, by the way, right? Just because someone keeps nagging at you, that is not justice. Then also, hear what the unjust judge said. Shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night, him though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Now, when you put that line on the end of that parable, you go, what? What? What on earth is that comment about will he find faith on earth got anything to do with a widow who's banging on the door of a judge night after night and screaming and crying and wailing? And you go, well, no, this is about faith. You need perseverance. No, you don't need perseverance in faith. Faith is faith. You've got faith. You keep it. You move with faith. You live in faith. Faith is what it is. Of course you keep going in faith. And of course, he says, this is why people keep crying out to me, God will avenge and so on. Why that comment about will he find faith when the Son of Man returns? What is the link? It's a really interesting link, actually, when you read it in that way. When the Son of Man returns, it's the end period. You know, Yeshua comes back, we're wrapping up of history. Will he find faith? What's that telling us about what's preceded that about justice? What then creates real justice in a society and in this world? And in particular, of course, that parable is addressed to Israel. He's talking to his own people, first and foremost. It's quite interesting. The context of all of this, loss of justice, when faith is low, when faith is weak, or when faith is at the point of disappearing, will he find faith on earth? And the unspoken, unwritten thought at that point is effectively, probably not. Why else would Yeshua have asked it? He's saying in those end days, faith is going to be almost non-existent. That's how tough it's going to be. But as a result of that lack of faith, you connect it with the parable that's gone before it, and you begin to understand one direct outcome of a low level of faith is that justice becomes unjust and corrupt. There's a linkage which goes on here. Justice goes out the window. And it's not just that low faith is the hallmark of the end times, but clearly that is included within it. I think the bigger picture with the parable is that it's not just will he find faith, when Yeshua comes, will he find justice in this world? Or will it be so corrupt that everything will be falling apart? If he doesn't find faith, real, deep, Abrahamic faith, there will be no zero justice on the earth either. If justice becomes politicized, if it becomes corrupted, if it's not neutral, then justice goes down the pan. That's not real justice anymore. And it's interesting, when faith is low, the judge described it at the beginning, he had no fear of God and no fear of man. This is not a man of faith. He didn't have faith. He was just using the justice system for his own ends, to get what he could from it. It's indicative of low faith. When faith is low, you revert to type. And human beings, we know what they are like when they revert to type. You become animals. We see it everywhere in this world. That's where a lack of faith will take you. The writer to the book of Hebrews says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Why? Because if faith is low and justice goes out the window, it is impossible to please God, because God seeks justice. Real justice. I want to put it to you that wherever we see a lack of justice in this world is indicative of lack of faith. That people have stopped fearing God. They're abusing the justice system for their own ends. That is indicative of a very low fear of God. Treating justice as a game. Because it leads to partiality. It leads to treating the vulnerable differently, because the vulnerable are always right. Right? You'd be open to bribes, open to corruption, not listening to both sides equally, not actually taking the time to dig deep into the research for the evidence to find out what's really going on. A man of faith, a woman of faith in a judge position, will take the time to do that, find the evidence base, and then be impartial in their judgment. Doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, whether you're vulnerable, or you're the owner of the biggest company, you're the CEO, whatever. It's irrelevant. Justice must be impartial in that way, because God is impartial. You know, the Lord is not going to, when we get to the end of it all, and we're, you know, that we're standing in the queue at the pearly gates, as it were, you know, he's not going to stand there and go, oh, you lot, you were all homeless. Oh, just come on in. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You can be homeless and you can be a desperately wicked person and sinner. But if all you see is the homelessness, you will not carry through justice if that is all you see. If I go deeper than that, I'm not saying we shouldn't be kind to vulnerable people and homeless people. If you see them, please go and buy them a sandwich. Help them. Do what you can. Absolutely, you should do that. But you should not be blinded by that when it comes to justice. That's what the Torah says. And God is just. Always. And when he passes judgment, it is always right. And if you've experienced God's judgment in the past, and I know I have, when I've been out of order, I'm thankful that he was merciful at times as well. But my goodness, when you fall into the hands of the living God, it is a fearful thing. Because he knows how to judge. And it's bang on right for what you've done or said or thought or whatever. That is our God. The end times are certainly going to be characterized by that. And when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith? Will he find justice? Will he find that in your life? You know, it was uppermost in his own mind when he was talking to his own people. You know, Yeshua was not talking to some imaginary church here in Luke 18. He's not talking to Christians. There were none. He's not saying, you know, Luke 18, oh, this, I'm going to save this up, I'm going to say it, but the PS at the bottom of the page is, please don't read until there's a church at the end of time. No, that's not what it says. He's talking to Israel, he's talking to his people. Okay? Will you find faith? Will you find justice? True institutional righteousness in the land and in the country? Will you find this when he returns? Will you find it in you? Will you find you seeking, pursuing justice? I don't mean like I'm going to war with someone. That's not what justice is. Will you live in a just way that actually takes the time to understand what is truly right and wrong in every situation that you face? No knee-jerk reactions, no hissy fits. But to take the time. Will you find that level of faith in you and justice in you? Or will that also be a casualty of faithless lives? If we act in unjust ways, we are not pleasing God. The one who gave us the Torah, it reveals a lack of faith in all who behave in this way. I just picked out three sections from the Torah there about justice this morning. There are many more. It is obvious when you do a quick search on this in your commentaries and so on. It's obvious when you do this, this is an absolute bedrock concept of what Judaism is all about, the scriptures are all about, because God is about justice. Always. And he hates injustice. And we see it as we began this sermon today. We see it in the sacrifices. God pursues justice. Justice is found in sacrifice. It is there because it's core to who God is. It's core to what God is doing in this world. Substitutionary sacrifice in that way is primarily about justice before God. That we can be found righteous before him because that's who he is. Amen.